Hello, and welcome to Lies.com podcast number 4. This one's going to be different in several respects. For one thing, I'm recording it without a script. You can probably tell if you've listened to the others that I basically wrote them all out in advance and then read them, trying to sound like I wasn't reading them. But this time I'm just yakking. We'll see how that goes. If you can't take some chances while recording something for 2 or 3 people to listen to, then I can't imagine when you would take chances. Also, I'm actually recording this one out in the wild. I'm actually sitting in my minivan in a parking lot at UC Santa Barbara, waiting for my daughter to finish volleyball practice. So there may be a little more ambient noise in the background. We'll see. I won't be using any found audio or music in this podcast. So maybe the sound of trucks passing by and whatnot will make up for that somewhat. I'll try not to be as obnoxious in doing this as Dave Weiner is in some of his morning coffee notes that I talked about last time around. I won't do any singing. I won't make you wait while I go get coffee. But hopefully I can keep things moving along well enough to keep you at least somewhat interested. It was a fairly eventful week for me. On Thursday, on the way back from a trip to Disneyland that the family made, we were hit by a car on the 5 freeway. Basically, I was asleep in the passenger seat at the time while Linda, my wife, was driving. And all I really remember of it is a screech and a big thump. Car was kind of thrown. Our car was hit on the right rear corner, and we were thrown to the right and ended up traversing across the lanes of traffic. I was awake at that point, looking out my window at the oncoming cars, hoping that we weren't going to be subject to a big collision, but without really a lot of time to think about it. And very fortunately, we weren't hit again. We bounced off the car that had initially hit us once on the way over to the right side of the road, where that other car ran into a cement barrier and ended up in the right-hand lane. There wasn't any shoulder there, and we ended up in that same right-hand lane, a few car lengths in front of her car. So while it was scary, and potentially could have been really bad, it turned out more or less okay. None of the 4 people in our car, my wife, myself, my daughter, and my 14-year-old daughter now, and my, or almost now, her birthday's coming up in a week, and my 7-year-old son, all of us were okay, just a little scared, but all right. The lady driving the other car was pretty distraught. She spent probably the next 40 minutes while we were waiting for the CHP to arrive, crying and, you know, just being fairly hysterical, you know, saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," over and over again. And her daughter, who I guess was about 2 years old or so, was obviously pretty upset also, but as far as I can tell, neither of them were injured in any significant sense. So it all turned out much better than it could have, and thankfully you know, we're all safe and sound. So that was a big event in my week. Also, I was in the local newspaper, the Santa Barbara News Press, did a follow-up story on the incident from back around the new year when Julie and I were out riding our bikes and came across a man who had tried to cross a stream crossing where there's like a cement road that led across a stream. And being that it was fairly soon after a big storm, one of the big storms we'd had this winter out here in California, there was a lot of water going over the crossing and his car was swept off. And he was stuck, basically, in his car in the middle of this creek. So that was a big, exciting event. And you can, if you haven't read the story on lies.com, you can certainly check it out there. I won't go into all the detail. But we were in the news back then, and now the news press did a follow-up story where they interviewed Lorenzo Dell'Armi, the man who was rescued from his car. Or actually mostly rescued himself from the car. He was rescued from the bank after exiting his car and being tumbled down the creek. But there was this article that talked about how it still haunts him and how it's affected his life. And the reporter also did a follow-up interview with me and ended up using as quotations a lot of the stuff that I wrote in my write-up on lies.com, which I gave to her during the interview. And so that was somewhat exciting, seeing myself in print. It was comical to most of the people who saw it, who know me, in that among the one of the things she got wrong, and the reporter got wrong in describing me, was that she described me as being 32 years old, which, you know, I'm flattered that she thought that. Hopefully, I flatter myself that she actually thought I was 32, as opposed to just being a random typo, which I suppose is also pretty possible. But in fact, I'm 43, so the difference is significant, and Linda, my wife, was mortified. She was gratified, I guess, I should say, that it didn't identify her by age, since the discrepancy in our ages would have been embarrassing to her, would have made her out to be some kind of cradle robber. And since we just celebrated our 21st anniversary, I joked to her that, well, this means that I must have been married when I was 11. Anyway, so it was fun to see that story in the paper. So those were sort of the highlights of the week in my personal life. Oh, and also there was Julia's birthday party, which was also a lot of fun. She had her party down at the beach, and we rented some big inner tubes, and she and the bevy of 13 and 14-year-old girls who attended were out playing in the surf with those for most of the time, and that actually would have been a great place to do a mobile podcast with better audio equipment than I actually have. You could have enjoyed the sound of them screaming with delight every time a wave hit one of their inner tubes they were hanging onto. So aside from me personally, there were also some significant events in terms of the life of lies.com. There was a bit of soul-searching I did early in the week, and I guess since I'm yakking without a script, I can go back and just give some of the detail of that. In Ishar, the MUD, the sort of online multi-user chat environment, ostensibly a Daiku adventure-style MUD where people attack monsters and stuff, but I hang out in there in the godly realm where it's more just a glorified chat room. There was some discussion as I was ranting, as I'm wont to do, in sort of unedited mode, about some aspect of the Bush administration or some, I can't even remember now what incident it was. It was from, you know, last week. It may have been the Newsweek memo. It may have been, actually, I know what it was. It was the follow-up to the Tony Blair memo that I've talked about in previous podcasts and certainly talked about several times on the site. The secret memo from the meeting in 2002, July of 2002, where the head of MI6 was reporting back to Tony Blair and his top aides on meetings he'd had in Washington with the members of the Bush team, and basically just gives a sort of an uncensored view of what was really being discussed at the high levels between the Bush and Blair governments at that time with respect to Iraq. And as I said in talking about it previously, you know, I don't see that as a big piece of earth-shaking news. And in fact, I think some of the discussion of that memo in the British press, at least, has kind of focused on the same thing, that, you know, it really wasn't anything that new. Most of the information there was already revealed a long time ago. But it's significant to me in that it adds another layer of evidence to the sort of ongoing mountain of, you know, the ongoing accumulation of evidence that Bush did not seriously intend to give Saddam a chance to disarm peacefully, that he had settled on a course of going to war certainly before July of 2002 and possibly several months before then, at a time when he was still publicly saying that, you know, he was going through the UN and giving the weapons inspectors a chance and giving Saddam a chance to disarm, and that he was, you know, pursuing a peaceful solution and war only as a last resort. And this was the sort of rhetoric that surrounded the congressional resolution on the use of force, that the vote that took place just before the midterm elections in November of 2002. So anyway, it's a, you know, piece of evidence that to me is a challenge to the Bush supporters who I think have continued, many of them at least, in the the blogosphere, the right-wing blogosphere, have continued to support Bush and to claim that he was genuinely misled by bad intelligence on the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't that he was perverting that intelligence in the direction of making Saddam look worse than he really was. He wasn't looking to exaggerate the nature of the threat represented by Saddam in order to build support for going to war. And, you know, to me, that's a non-starter, pretty much. I look at, you know, I've been focused on this evidence since then and have gradually seen my suspicions confirmed in multiple ways. And this memo is just the latest of them. But I was talking about this in Ishar, in the mud. And as sometimes happens, I think I was talking more than anyone else was really interested in hearing. And Hero, in particular, who's certainly one of the leading members of the Ishar God community, and someone I have a lot of respect for, at one point responded with some negative comment about my bias and my willingness to see everything through, you know, see everything related to Bush through sort of crap-colored glasses and interpret everything in the worst possible light based on my pre-existing Bush hatred, and to dismiss those who might actually, you know, just honestly disagree with me based on their own take on the evidence, to dismiss them as dishonest or stupid or not just ill-informed but sort of willfully ill-informed. And that hit home with me. If you followed lies.com for any significant amount of its history, you know that I'm big on ambiguity. I tend to sort of oscillate between these twin poles of loud indignation about the political right and sounding very strong and convinced of my moral and intellectual superiority in terms of these issues, but sometimes drawing back from that and basically feeling that, you know, on a deeper level, I really don't know the answers to these things. I'm not as sure as I sometimes come off. And I think that those comments from Hero, his comments kind of put me in that place again of thinking, you know, what am I doing here? Am I fooling myself? You know, and this led to my posting an item on the site that I titled the lies.com manifesto. And it was a case of wanting to really put out there the standard I'd like to try to live up to, and that I'd like the readers of the site and the commenters on the items on the site to help me live up to by calling me on it when they see me failing to achieve that. So here, I'm going to go ahead and read it as I posted it on the site. So here it is. I'm tired of being lied to. I don't like it when other people do it to me, and I really don't like it when I do it to myself, by which I mean when I fool myself into accepting as true something that's false, or accepting as false something that's true, merely because doing so matches up with my pre-existing biases. So I'm going to do something about it. Henceforth, for the purposes of my posting and commenting on this site, I'm going to make a conscious effort to evaluate claims without regard to who's making those claims. If someone is bullshitting and I find out about it, I'm going to call them on it, regardless of who they are or what position they're advocating. If someone is telling the truth, I'll acknowledge it, regardless of who they are or what position they're advocating. In either case, I'll do my best to evaluate sources objectively, without regard to whether their statements happen to conform with my pre-existing biases. Also, I will do my best to clearly distinguish between my statements of fact and my statements of opinion, and in the case of the former, to provide supporting information, like links to outside sources, so you can make your own evaluation of my conclusions. I'm asking you, the readers of this site, to help keep me honest about this. If you think I've violated one or more of the commitments given above, say so, either in email or, preferably, in a comment on the item in question. This manifesto isn't really new, since I've been trying to do this all along. It's called Being Honest, and I think most people try to do it, at least when dealing with themselves. What's new here is that I'm stating the guidelines explicitly and publicly pledging to adhere to them and committing myself to take it very, very seriously whenever someone asserts that I've violated them. Note that I'll be using this same approach when evaluating users' assertions that I failed to live up to the manifesto. So to the extent you can provide actual evidence, for example, in the form of links to supporting sources, which naturally will be subject to the same sort of evaluation, rather than merely asserting that I've blown it, that will tend to give your words more weight. Disclaimer, There is one form of bias I intend to preserve. In fact, I intend to strengthen it. It's this. I will, as I said, do my best to evaluate the truthfulness of sources objectively. Before putting someone in the demonstrated to be unreliable category, I'll perform a careful and, to the extent I can manage it, unbiased investigation of that someone's truthfulness. But having once determined that someone's assertions are unreliable, I'm going to be strongly biased against accepting that source's assertions at face value in the future. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, won't get fooled again. Thanks. So, there's my manifesto. And you could argue I failed, even at the outset, in my goal of being an objective, impartial arbiter of truth on the site, since I couldn't resist putting a little backhanded dig at George Bush there by quoting him at the end with his muffed truism that he famously made, I guess it was fairly early in his first term, where he just couldn't bring himself to say, shame on me. This is sort of one of the many examples of his, well, I won't get into it. I just won't get into it. So, anyway, there you have the lies.com manifesto, and I'm serious about really trying to live up to that. I'd like the site to be more useful, to have it actually achieve something worthwhile. I think I was impressed by Wikipedia when I was doing some research that ended up in the Teddy Roosevelt item in my previous podcast about the Spanish-American War and Mark Twain and the War Prayer short story that Twain wrote. I find what they've done at Wikipedia very impressive and a neat example of what can be achieved with a good focus and a commitment to objectivity and really being true to a site's goals and following through on them. And in a smaller way, I'd like to see lies.com able to achieve something similarly worthwhile. And I see this manifesto and my efforts to live up to it going forward as possibly playing a part in that. A couple of items that appeared on the site since then were sort of influenced by that manifesto. One of them was, let's see if I can find it here. Because I'm not actually online. I'm limited to those pages from the site that I pulled up in my browser and had left there ready to be used as I did this recording session parked at the parking lot at UCSB. But I do have this one pulled up. And this was the item that I posted somewhat before I posted the manifesto, but in thinking about it after the fact, I looked back at it and did my own little follow-up on it. This was the where I posted to an item by Howard Zinn, who's a well-known leftist, whose works I generally agree with, whose opinions I generally agree with, and sort of in a cheerleading sense. You know, I like to see what he's saying, and I'm happy that there's someone out there saying those things. But in reading over it in the wake of this manifesto, and especially in seeing Lies user Steve, who's someone who I think, you know, I also have a lot of, what's the word I want, a lot of respect for his political views. He commented that, you know, while he agrees with the criticism of nationalism that Zinn made, he really couldn't read the piece and found it, you know, kind of difficult to get through because of some of the same elements that I found on looking back at it again, disturbing. So I went through it again and picked out a few items in it that I thought were sort of logically suspect, and it made me kind of retract what I had said in my initial posting of it, where I made the comment that, sadly, I suspect that some of those who could benefit most from reading Zinn's thought-provoking essay will be the first to dismiss it unread, based merely on who it is doing the speaking. So if you want an example of my own vacillation, you can look at that item where I posted that one day, and then, you know, 24 hours later, or however long it was, had basically posted that, you know, actually, I find myself feeling that from an objective standpoint, Zinn's comments really aren't that useful because he's really not proceeding on a rational basis. He's making some sort of wide, some major leaps, some logical leaps in putting his case together and not really proceeding in a manner designed so much to discover and explicate the truth as it is designed to be advocacy. And I see a real danger in that, even if, as in this case, I basically agree with the view that he's promoting. I want to see if I've got another item here. Yeah, okay. This one actually got some favorable comment from Jason, who I think of more as Arctos, since that's his name in Ishar. But it was the item on the additional detail to come out about some deaths in U.S. custody of these two Afghan detainees a while ago. Well, the article came out recently, but it's reporting on some deaths that happened a while back. And I basically just, where in previous time I might have gotten into some real strong condemnation of the Bush administration specifically for sort of creating the conditions that I think have contributed to events like this. In this case, I backed off from that and basically just offered the facts as given in the New York Times piece and finished by saying, you can support Bush's war on terror or not. View the larger goals of our military action in Afghanistan as justifying this sort of thing or not. But regardless of what position you take on that, you have an obligation, I think, to include the specifics of what actually happened in this case in your cost-benefit analysis. And I let it go at that. You know, I think something like torture carried out by U.S. military forces against people who not only subsequently are revealed to be innocent, but who at the time are basically suspected by most of the people conducting the interrogating, basically presumed to be innocent based on the information they've been able to extract from them. To torture those people to death, to actually, you know, beat them to a point where they die in custody, shackled with their hands over their heads in a jail cell in Afghanistan. I don't think I need to get on my moral high horse in talking about that. I think those facts speak for themselves. And if I'm in the sort of country, if I'm living in the kind of country that I like to believe I am living in, I think good moral people will respond to that kind of information and will take steps to correct that problem. But it certainly is depressing anyway. So, that's kind of my bit on the Lies.com manifesto. One more sort of classic Lies.com item that came up a lot this week was the incident with Newsweek's retraction of their initial story about an investigation at Guantanamo showing that U.S. military personnel had flushed a Koran down a toilet, and this item appearing, this very brief item appearing in a Newsweek piece, was linked in many people's minds with rioting. It was cited by radical Muslim demonstrators as a factor in their rioting that led to 15 deaths. And the right-wing blogosphere taking their lead from the Bush administration, from Condoleezza Rice and Scott McClellan, made a very big deal about this in the media, really castigating Newsweek for their failure of journalistic ethics in publishing this story based on a source who turned out to be unreliable, a source who subsequently said that, well, he maybe didn't actually know that that had happened, or he didn't recall seeing the report that described that happening. And then the right-wing weblogs took that further to the point of saying, well, this was an example of how Newsweek was criminally culpable for having set out to foist these lies upon the public in their zeal to bring down Bush. And I just personally found this a really laughable example. In fact, my wife did something she doesn't normally do, in that she heard some of Rice's comments on NPR, I think, and she actually phoned me from the car to just sputter at me in indignation at the ludicrous nature of the Bush White House having the gall to lecture Newsweek on having sullied the United States' reputation in the Islamic world. It was a case of the sort of the black hole calling the kettle black. But in thinking about this story some more, and an item that I posted, I think, just today or yesterday, I talked about it, that, you know, yeah, I think there's a real irony there, but on a deeper level, there's something kind of actually fairly sophisticated going on by the Bush folks that I think is worth noticing. And that's that there's a kind of information judo that they're practicing here. It's very reminiscent to me of the Dan Rather Gate incident with the memo that alleged to provide more documentation of Bush's spotty National Guard record, you know, this scandal that erupted during the campaign, not focusing on Bush's National Guard record so much, but focusing on Dan Rather's use of this memo that turned out to be a fairly crude forgery. And, of course, many people credit that with bringing Dan Rather down and actually leading to his stepping down at CBS. And I think the thing that resonates for me about each of these cases is that, and I'll just, again, quote myself from the site, in each case we have a media outlet that's run a story that's damaging to the Bush team, where the specific evidence used turns out to be bogus, or maybe in this latest case with the Koran story is just at least potentially bogus. But in each case, there also is substantial other evidence that makes the story seem plausible. You know, we've got lots of other information about Bush's National Guard record that has never been adequately explained. And again, with, you know, there's a long history of many sources, not just Newsweek, talking about overt actions on the part of interrogators at Guantanamo and then later at Abu Ghraib, doing things, you know, to try and break the spirit of detainees as part of the interrogation process, involving actions that could certainly contribute to anti-U.S. sentiment in the Muslim world, with Qurans and, you know, stepping on Qurans and different. We can go into the details if you want to look them up. They're referenced in that item on lies.com. But anyway, there's substantial existing information that sort of raises the question about the same thing that this specific story talks about. But then by attacking the specific piece of bogus evidence while leaving this larger body of corroborating evidence unmentioned, the Bush people are able to fight the public relations battle on ground of their choosing. And this is the sort of sophisticated waging of information warfare that I'm noticing here. You know, so suddenly the story isn't about the underlying scandal of, you know, Bush's National Guard record or the ill treatment of Muslim prisoners, but instead it's about the lax reporting standards and irrational anti-Bush animus at the mainstream media. Now, since the media outlet in each case actually does operate within an ethical framework that compels it to acknowledge its own errors, the engagement plays out favorably for the Bush people. They make lots of hay, you know, they make hay while the sun shines over this specific media screw-up and leave the larger body of evidence unacknowledged and uncontested. And then, having undercut their opponent's credibility, they simply move on to whatever the next battle is that they've defined as offering the best chance of playing out in their favor. So, because they're operating largely outside the media's self-imposed requirements for fairness and accountability, the Bush people and their supporters in the echo chamber are in effect fighting a guerrilla war of information. It's an unconventional, asymmetrical conflict. You know, they use the strength of the opponent against him. They snipe from behind trees and hedgerows at the enemy's massed troops. They leave their improvised roadside explosives to blow up in the enemy's face, and then they melt away to fight another day rather than facing the enemy's counterattack. So it's pretty slick stuff, and it's clearly very effective. And I'm not sure that, manifesto or not, that a concern for objective truth and a sense of fairness and balance is going to win out in the long run over that kind of approach. But I guess we'll see. I've said previously on lies.com, and I believe this, that there are certain fights that it's more important to engage in and to fight in a certain way, even if the end doesn't look that good. Even if you end up losing, there's some battles it's better to have fought and lost, I think, than to have compromised your values in order to increase your chances of winning them. Now, granted, it's much easier to say that when the negative consequences of losing that battle are still comfortably far in the future. And there certainly does come a time when, you know, you've got an oncoming train and you can stand on principles and remain on the tracks, or you can step off and again live to fight another day. And I think those are questions that you just have to decide on a case-by-case basis. You have to use whatever judgment and wisdom you can muster to try to make sense of what's true and base your actions on that understanding. Anyway, on that note, I will conclude this lies.com podcast number 4. I want to thank everybody that I've mentioned, but I don't have a long list of them like I have in previous podcasts, so I'll just say thank you, generally, to all the folks who help out with lies.com and all the folks who enrich my life online and offline. This podcast is copyrighted and is distributed under the Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thank you for listening.